So with that, we will move on to item 10 and our open session agenda, which is consider and take possible action to adopt resolution 2021-5, authorizing actions in compliance with Assembly Bill 197 and the Alameda decision. So let me turn this over to Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This item has to do with recommended actions for the board in compliance with the Alameda decision. The Alameda decision was a decision issued by the California Supreme Court in the AB 197 lawsuit. Sicera and two other retirement systems were sued in that particular lawsuit back in 2012. Just before AB 197 was enacted. Basically, the California Supreme Court upheld the statutory exclusions from compensation earnable of a variety of elements of pay. For Sicera, the effective date of those exclusions was for retirements on or after July 12th of 2014 by virtue of a court order that stayed the implementation of the new law until that date. And so between 1-1-2013 and July 12th, 2014, this court order, the stay order, required Sicera to continue to include these pay items. And so the recommendation today actually was before the board in July as well. And at that point, the board considered the recommendation and the information available to it, as well as public comment, requested additional information to come before the board. We have that additional information for you here today in attachment 4 in the items packet. And before we go there and have the attorneys from the Ice Miller firm go over their advice that is contained in that letter, I will turn it over to Christina Dunn for some additional background.
Yes, so the resolution that we have in the packet today addresses the following items in connection with the Alameda decision. One of the items is the member contributions that were paid towards items that are no longer considered pensionable based on AB 197 and some potential refunds around that. The other item is the overpayments of benefits paid to the estoppel class. And these are members that retired after the stay order and had an estoppel benefit included in their retirement calculation. And then the third item is any other overpayments of benefits that arose from the inclusion of pay items that AB 197 determined were not pensionable. These are pay that were paid for services outside of normal working hours, such as on-call or standby pay, that were included in retirement calculations for members that retired after the stay order expired July 12, 2014. The resolution does not become effective until the conclusion of the three AB 197 lawsuits that are currently pending against Sicera. As we've mentioned, the scope of the resolution is for the contributions and benefits paid after July 12, 2014. And these would be for members that retired after July 12, 2014, as far as the benefits were included in those calculations. So we do have the actuaries here from Siegel Consulting. We have Paul, Angela, and Andy Young that can answer questions. And then, as Karen mentioned, we do have the attorneys, our outside tax counsel from Ice Miller, Rob Goss, and Audra Ferguson Allen, that we'll be able to discuss the additional information the board requested in July. So I'll hand it over to Rob and Audra.
Thank you. And thank you, Karen, and members of the board. You have, as part of your packet, our letter dated August the 25th of 2021. We were on the board's meeting earlier this morning in the open session and heard one of the questions that was specifically submitted prior to the board meeting with regard to the refund of contributions that were taken between the time that PEPRA became effective January 1, 2013, and the time that the court's stay order expired July 12, 2014. And you have our written opinion that those employee contributions that were taken prior to 2014 are not eligible to be refunded to employees based upon the terms of the plan as it existed at that time. If there are additional questions to be made from the board, we certainly would entertain it. Otherwise, our opinion as the board's or as the plan's tax counsel is that the only contributions eligible for refund are those that were taken on those pay items after July 12 of 2014.
All right, thank you, Rob. Are there any questions? Well, Audra, I don't know if you had anything to add to that, but if not, are there any questions for Rob or Audra on their letter or the opinions expressed therein? All right. Mm-hmm.
I have, yes. Have a statement. If that's okay to, I know this is coming up for a vote. So if, with your permission, I'd like to go ahead with that.
All right. You cut out just at the beginning. You indicated you wanted to make a statement, David. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure, of course.
Okay. So I know this is coming up for a vote. This proposal means a great deal to me. It's very concerning. It's very important and impacts our legacy members. And I will be voting no on the proposal. I've written an appeal to my colleagues here on the board. All of you I have a great deal of respect for and consider it an honor and a privilege to work alongside you. So please hear me out and see what you think. So it is undisputed that our legacy SACERA members have been harmed by AB 197. First, at the time of hire, legacy SACERA members entered into an agreement with the county regarding compensation. Part of that compensation included a pension based on specific pay inclusion items. Our members made monetary contributions towards these pay items to help cover the level of pension that they were due to receive. AB 197 eroded that level of pension by eliminating certain pay items from being pensionable. Many of my colleagues, those such as X-ray techs, hazmat workers, nurses, and others, have told me that this has meant for a 10 to 20% reduction, if not more, in their upcoming retirement payments. For our affected members, this is an earthquake that destabilizes the foundations of their financial homes. Second, since certain pay items are no longer pensionable, our legacy members have been making financial contributions towards part of a pension level that no longer exists. So, these contributions add no value to our legacy members' pensions. If those extra contributions had never been paid to the system, it would make no difference in the level of pensions that our legacy members would receive at retirement. These contributions were made in excess. They were empty investments. Our legacy members deserve to have these excess contributions refunded to them with interest. But the proposal before the SACERA board today tells our legacy members no. This proposal, if passed, will cause the simple absorption of our legacy members' excess contributions into SACERA's asset base. This is the 1-2 punch suffered by our legacy members. This is harm. For the SACERA board, isn't it our fiduciary duty to look after our members? Is it our desire to do so? Are we doing all that we can to mitigate the damage caused to our legacy SACERA members? If we are to act in good faith, we need to know the full extent of what we can do to protect our legacy members. We need to dig deeper. Our consultants at Ice Miller tell us that the Board of Retirement must be in compliance with the terms of our plan. Otherwise, we will have an operational failure. They state that an operational failure could cause SACERA to suffer a qualification failure, which could then put SACERA's standing with the IRS as a tax-exempt entity at risk. I agree. We must follow the terms of our plan. But how are these terms set? They are set by existing laws, and they are set by policies voted on by the retirement board. So, if we approve this policy proposal today, and later attempted to refund excess contributions to our legacy members, then yes, we would be out of compliance with the terms of our plan. But why not see if there is something more that we can do with policy that would allow our legacy members to be made whole? I believe that our board has more discretion in this matter than what we realize. What more can we find out? I have four main questions. One, is Ice Miller able to cite any IRS ruling addressing a similar situation? What has the IRS said in similar cases? Two, what are the risks to SACERA if it decides to consider the excess contributions made by our members as overpayments to the system and then decides to refund those overpayments? Three, can SACERA seek a private letter ruling from the IRS on whether it could refund excess contributions made by legacy SACERA members? And four, should SACERA hire a law firm to take a deep dive into this issue and make clear the options available to SACERA? I appreciate the information provided by Ice Miller, but it falls short. We need more detailed information about our alternatives and what risk those alternatives pose. We need to be able to make a fully informed decision. In good faith, and on behalf of our legacy members, we need to do our best to do what is right. We need to dig deeper into this matter. Until then, I urge you to vote no on this proposal. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, David. Harvey, if I can ask you for a moment to clarify what the plan is. I think in some prior discussions there's been a thought or a at least a belief that the plan was something wholly within the control of the CICERA board in terms of creating, developing, and implementing policy. And at least I had a different understanding from prior discussion. So if you could maybe clarify for purposes of this discussion what the plan actually means.
Sure, Scott. Our plan document is unusual because unlike in a 401k where you get a pamphlet that's about this thick, our plan document is something like this. And our plan document essentially is the statute that we're duty bound to follow, including the state constitution. The statute as interpreted by judicial decisions that tell us what the meaning of some of the statutory terms are, if there's any confusion. And that changes from time to time. It does include our policies, but the policies are only promulgated to be consistent and are only enforceable if they're consistent with the statute and the Constitution and the laws. And when I say statute, I mean the CERL, our governing, our primary administrative statute. But I also mean the Internal Revenue Code, HIPAA, for example, to the extent that systems like this get involved in medical benefits. So there's a panoply of federal and state laws that we're also subject to. That's all part of our plan document. Dr. McDonald and others may not have been on the board when we did. You remember those who were on the board several years ago when the IRS was going through the process of reviewing all of the county retirement systems and all governmental plans. CICERA literally had to deliver to the IRS its plan document, and it was multiple binders of laws that applied and regulations that we have to abide by. So Our, and to the extent our policies are part of our plan document, they are only legitimate if they're consistent with the statutory framework that we work under. And so when we talk about the plan document, you really have to include everything that charters this board's authority.
Great. Well, Harvey, thank you for the clarification and the reminder, because I like others, when I hear a phrase like the plan or a word like the plan, you think of a pamphlet or what have you, or a singular document that's the plan. But in actuality, it's the complete constitutional and statutory framework within which we operate. And that's not self-evident. So I appreciate the clarification. Other comments on item 10?
This is Candace, and I think it would also be helpful to have our council address some of the issues raised by David. I mean, David's been at a disadvantage because he's been conflicted out of our closed sessions. And David, every single one of your questions has really been posed by us. And particularly the question about an IRS letter, that was something I raised a few months ago or a few weeks ago. And I think it would be helpful for our council to provide the response they gave me. And I don't want to summarize it incorrectly, but essentially was, one, it would take a really long time, but two, we wouldn't get any different outcome. But anyway, that was one thing that I think should be addressed. And then I think it's also important to have counsel maybe elaborate a little bit more about why all of us have felt the equity of this is really, really challenging, but our hands are really bound by these rules and regulations. And so if our council doesn't mind elaborating a little bit more, I think that might be helpful, not just to Dr. McDonald, but also to any of our members who are listening.
Yeah, no, I think that's That's an excellent suggestion. I was just asking if there were other comments or questions to get them on the table, because I was going to ask Ice Miller, Rob and Audra to respond to the points that David made. Didn't know if there were any others that we wanted to get out on the table beyond those.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification, Scott.
And I'm looking for hands. I don't see any. So let me turn to Ice Miller, Rob and Audra. If you could address the points that were raised by Dr. McDonald, that would be appreciated.
Yeah, so we appreciate the comments. And as has been said, we have talked about this before, but unfortunately, I know you weren't a part of those conversations. I think first and foremost, it's important to keep in mind the type of plan that this is. So different from a 401k plan or another type of defined contribution plan, as a defined benefit plan, all of the assets are held together. So they are not held, although members make employee contributions, all of those contributions are held together in one trust. They are never broken out as contributions made by any one individual. Instead, the combination of the employee contributions, the employer contributions, and the investment returns are all held together for the benefit of all members and beneficiaries. So there's not any one individual account that an individual has such that there's been an overpayment. An overpayment under federal law with respect to a defined benefit plan means, when we're talking about a contribution, means that an individual has paid into the fund more than the plan said it was required to pay. And here, we have the plan, and Harvey did a nice job of summarizing what the plan means. But here we have the plan that said prior to 2014 that those were pensionable items. And so we don't have excess contributions that have been made based on the terms of the plan. Now, with respect to options that are be available, we did talk about whether or not there could be a retroactive plan amendment. So what that means is whether or not the plan could be changed so that pre-2014, the plan was amended to say those contributions are no longer accepted. So then you could refund those contributions. That's based on our conversations with Harvey. And Harvey, please speak up if I'm misquoting you. That's not a viable option because that would need to come from the state legislature. So short of changing the CERL, that would cause the board to violate the plan document because you can't change the plan in that way. We also talked about whether or not there could be a ruling from the IRS. So that would be through a private letter ruling. There is a cost to that. Currently, the user fee, so that's the fee that goes straight to the IRS, and it's not legal fees, is $38,000. The timing on that varies. So it can take anywhere from 9 to 12 months to 18 months, depending on the issue involved. We think it is extremely unlikely that the IRS would rule on this question. The IRS has the right to decline to rule, and we think that this is sufficiently intertwined state law, and the plan is clear in its terms as of pre-2014, that we think the IRS would most likely decline to rule. Rob, anything else you want to add?
Thank you. And Dr. McDonald, just to follow up on that thought from Audra, if we were to file a private letter ruling, it's the form is a letter where you explain the ruling that you're asking for. In this case, the ruling that you've suggested would be that you can make a refund of retirement contributions based upon the change in the law. And in describing the ruling that we want, we would have to describe what the plan terms require. And we do have some concern that when the IRS were to receive it, they would, as Audra said, not be inclined to rule, and they might even say, because this answer is dependent on the plan terms, we're not going to give you a refund of your filing fee back. They have suggested that in the past. It's discretionary as to whether they make that refund. The other question that you asked that I thought was directed towards us is whether the IRS has responded differently on other matters. And we don't necessarily know that answer, because these corrections, to the extent that filings occur with the IRS, these corrections occur in an anonymous communication only between the taxpayer and the IRS. The IRS doesn't issue a ruling that's public outside of the private letter ruling context. And so in a correction like this, what we really have is the IRS's procedures, as we outlined in that letter. That's what they've identified as the approved methods for making a correction. We are aware of one publicly available correction. It involved the city of Portland, Oregon, and I think their police department. And the IRS did require correction of overpayments to members, at least an attempt of correcting. It's not directly related to this situation. It is by analogy, to the extent that we can look at that and see the IRS would say, our policy requires that you correct. And that's what we see in this publicly available compliance statement, which is what the IRS issues on the back end of a correction. So in our experience, the IRS would require this, would not require a correction in the form of refund that predated July of 2014.
And I just wanted to add in full disclosure as well, seeking a PLR is not without some level of risk as well, if the IRS were to choose to adversely rule, so meaning rule against what we were asking them to rule, that can spark an audit from the IRS as well. So there is some level of risk in seeking a PLR.
Thank you, Audra, for the additional thoughts. David, yes.
Thank you. So a few points. With respect to individual accounts, I know that everything goes into one trust, but every year, every member gets an account of the contributions that they have made and of the interest that has been earned on those contributions, so that if an individual were to opt to cash out their retirement, they would realize all of their contributions plus interest. So in that sense, there is some individual accounting. Also, with respect to the state, I know it's a very involved process, but it still opens the possibility to appeal this to the state via state legislation. And that's happened before with changes to our retirement system with respect to changes in tiers and all that stuff. So we've been through that before. So that is an option. So otherwise, we have no real examples of similar situations, aside maybe that Portland situation, that we could use as precedents or case law, whatever. All we have is that we would pretty much have to do this submit this request to to the IRS and hope for the best. And so I understand a concern about a potential audit, but I've been very impressed by Sisera and how we run and how above board we are. And that doesn't guarantee you any negative impact. I understand that. But I would have complete confidence in our compliance and management teams to be able to handle an audit. And then with respect to the fee of $38,000, I understand that's a lot. But when we're talking about the employee contributions, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars. So it's a hefty fee, but I don't see how that gets in the way. Thank you.
All right, thank you, David. Any other comments or questions for our outside tax counsel or in-house counsel?
I think Other analogous situations that you can see throughout the country, though, are pension reforms. So it happens every legislative session in numerous different states and jurisdictions. So I do think that is analogous. You do not really see IRS ruling on those issues because oftentimes those type of pension reforms, even pension changes and cutbacks, will turn on individual state law, which obviously the IRS does not get entangled with issues of state law. So I just wanted to raise that as a potentially other analogous type of situation.
All right. Thank you, Audra. Any other thoughts or comments on this, or if appropriate, is there a motion?
Scott, this might be a good time to see if there are any additional public comments on this item.
Sure, thank you, Karen. Do we have, Christina, do we have any additional public comment on this item?
Yes, we have one.
Okay.
From Jack Funk, did the Ice-Miller opinion letter and comments take into account the language of the Nowicki case in considering the limits of the retirement board's discretion to undo previously granted pension elements? It would seem that any retirees impacted by the proposal should be entitled to the pension as set upon their date of retirement.
So, no, we did not. We are federal tax counsel, so I will defer to Harvey on any questions of application of state law.
Well, before anybody goes any further, this is a comment on the item, and in my judgment, we don't comment on matters of pending litigation, at least from my perspective. Harvey, I don't know if you have a different view on that, but I think that's where I would land.
I don't have a different view on that, but I will say the subject matter that's raised by this question is a really good one right now, because if I may, the measure of this board's discretion is bounded by what we talked about, our plan document, the law, and we are not in the, unfortunately or fortunately, for the board members, we're not in the plan design business. We administer a plan that is given to us by others. And in this case, this plan that we administer was designed by the state legislature. And when challenges were made to the state legislature, I'll remind everybody that this board remained neutral. It did not take a position on whether the legislature acted properly or acted improperly. That wasn't our role. And we watched the parties with a stake in that issue litigate it to the state Supreme Court, the highest court that tells us how to interpret that statute. So our neutrality in this litigation was a talisman for this board's limited discretion over the design of this plan. And as a consequence, while we all viscerally find it difficult to believe that the legislature of the state and the state Supreme Court changed the rules of the game in the middle of people's careers, it is not up to this board to try to design around that. The plan that we were given by the legislature and the state Supreme Court is the plan that we have to administer regardless of the consequences. We have zero discretion to change the design of this plan in ways that we think might seem equitable to our members. And Dr. McDonald, you're right, it's a bummer. It's a bummer for people to be paying into a system with the expectation, based on what the plan was when they came in, of what they would receive 30 years later when they retire. But the rug was pulled out from under them, and the Supreme Court of this state said that was appropriate within the legislature's authority, and we're stuck with it, quite frankly. And the best this board can do is to try to administer it as fairly and appropriately as we can. We cannot change the terms.
Thank you, Harvey. I know that we can't change AB 197. We're screwed. That's fact.
Yep.
But at least ACERA can do something with respect to those excess contributions made by legacy members to give them at least some relief. This, a refund of the contributions comes nowhere close to making anything right, but it is still something. And that's important for our legacy members.
But I'm just going to jump in if I can, Scott.
Yes.
You know, David, this is something that each one of us has asked our council to delve into, because like you, we've said at the very least, shouldn't people at least get back the contributions they made, with the understanding, you know, not even the employer contribution, because they've already got a UAL, but the actual individuals. And so over the last several months, we have asked council that, because it does seem fair. And this is what we came back with. What was returned to us was, the legal opinion that we've received today, that we really do not have that ability, that is without scope of our authority as board members. And so, yes, it is unfortunate, and there's not a good answer for it. You know, a few analogies have been provided to us during the course of it, how oftentimes employees do pay into, you know, I think the most common one we've been given is sort of the idea that, you know, someone who might be an officer who might be have motorcycle duty, where he is paying in for a period of time, assuming that his benefit will be enhanced because he is riding a motorcycle, then he moves on to another position. He's no longer riding a motorcycle. That's not calculated into his final pension benefit. He doesn't get a refund of that portion. And you know, that's the closest analogy that I've seen, Harvey. There must be better analogies than that one, but it is unfortunate, because it's something we've all been grasping for. And in the closed sessions where we've been discussing this litigation, we have really been asking our council to delve into it. So it's not just you feeling this passion. I think each one of us are looking at the same, isn't there some way we can do this? And the answer we've received is no, there really isn't.
If I may, Scott, just to comment on that. Yeah, it's the nature of this defined benefit plan that contributions that are made during a career are based upon actuarial projections of what a benefit might be for that individual 30 years out in the future. Projection. And we pay contributions, our members pay contributions on projections, not on reality. When they retire, that is the time when the benefit is calculated. It's calculated based upon the selection of, you know, a year's worth of income, pensionable pay items in that particular year. And then there's a formula applied. But there's never been a true up of some kind to try to say, well, you've paid so much in contributions and you're only going to get something a little less than that now in retirement. So we're going to true up your contributions so they become actually, you know, 50% of the cost of your benefits or not. That doesn't exist. So it's the nature of this defined benefit plan. It's almost an irony because the benefit isn't defined until you actually retire.
Yep.
It isn't defined when you're making contributions. So you don't lock in every single pay item during your career as a pensionable, as a, just because you're making contributions on it. That doesn't mean you're going to get it when you retire as a pensionable pay item in your final comp period. And then there's no true up at that point to say, well, you overpaid, you underpaid, you got away with paying less, you got away with, you know, some people pay more. And because all the assets of the system are there to pay all the benefits for all the members, regardless of tier, legacy, PEPRA, whatever, we don't segregate a member account and true it up at retirement and say you overpaid or you underpaid. There is no such thing as excess contributions absent an error. If a mathematical error was made, yes, you could have excess or a deficit. But there is absolutely no such thing as excess contributions when you make your member contribution on an item of pay you get in your first year, your fifth year, your eighth year, your 28th year. And it doesn't matter what you've paid contributions on during that period of time. What matters is your 1 or your 3 year final comp period and what elements of pay are pensionable in that period. And that isn't known until the end of your career. So it seems unfair. It seems that there are so-called excess contributions. There simply aren't.
Hey, let me make a clarification. And Candace, thank you very much for your comments, and you too, Harvey. But for legacy SACERA members, it's not the final year. It's the 12 highest contiguous months of income. So if you are a deputy riding a motorcycle and there's a stipend attached to that, and then you get promoted, and your level of income with that promotion is above and beyond what you are making with the stipend, it's the amount that you've, the highest amount that you've made, that's what your pension is calculated on. It's not the last year. It's the 12 best months within your career. So if you were working at a certain level and then you decided, oh, you know what, I don't want to work this hard. I'm going to take a job that's going to pay less and so forth for the last 5 years of my career. Your pension is still calculated on your best 12 months during your career. So,
Only on the pensionable pay items.
Right.
Sure. Okay.
At the time of your retirement, at the time of your retirement, the pay items, even if you're reaching back 5 years, must be pensionable at the date of retirement.
So, I'm... You know, I want to speak to David's points. To a person on this board, every item you raise, without disclosing the content of closed session discussions, was thoroughly vetted. And I think you've heard from the cross section of this board that to a person, everybody feels the same way about the equities involved here, and what struck me during this discussion, because it was so focused and it was so detailed, were certain what I would call for myself aha moments that maybe were a little belated, but they were no less aha moments. One was the point Harvey just got through making, that about when and how pensionable compensation is finally determined at the end, and that there are no true ups along the way, and you know, on a member basis, and fundamentally that the plan documents, which I would say there was a strong sentiment of thought that we could amend the plan documents to implement a policy along the lines that you discussed. And the answer was the plan documents are really the entirety of constitutional and state law, which create and define the plan. And we don't get to amend the plan. And I think, at least for some of us, I know certainly for me, that was a little bit of a wake-up call, because I had labored under the misapprehension that we could potentially amend the plan in certain ways to effectuate policy. Not the case. And so this is a study in constraints, and the most telling one of all is that when the legislature acted in 2012 to fundamentally change the pension law, including AB 197, it changed the plan documents in a way that the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, has said is valid and will be enforced. And that's the plan document we have. So the constraints are many, the avenues are narrow. But I'll tell you, to a person, I think everybody has felt and shared the thoughts that you expressed today. So I mean, a lot of thoughts gone into this. We have experienced expert outside tax counsel and Ice Miller, Audra, and Rob here today. We've had the best and brightest look at these questions, and I'm satisfied that we're left with the choices we in fact have, and we'll do the best with what we have. And with that, if there are no further comments, we would entertain a motion. Yes, Mr. Holcomb.
I'm prepared to move the proposed resolution.
And I'll second.
All right, there is a motion and a second to move resolution 2021-5, authorizing actions in compliance with Assembly Bill 197 and the Alameda decision.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do have one additional public comment that just came in, if you'd like me to read it.
Yes.
It's from Jack Funk. The Alameda case did not find that retirement boards acted illegally or improperly when authorizing pensionable elements that were not required under the Ventura decision. Those pension elements that attached at the time of retirement are fixed absent fraud or miscalculation.
All right. Thank you, Christina. All right, so we've had one additional comment. There's a motion on the floor. It's been seconded. Any further discussion on the item? All right, seeing none, we will call the roll on the motion. Anderson.
Aye.
Chabadarev.
Aye.
Finley.
Aye.
Gordon. Aye. Holcomb.
Aye.
Kroll.
Aye.
McDonald.
No.
Phillips?
Aye.
And Watts?
Aye.
All right, the motion passes on an 8-1 vote adopting resolution 2021-5. Thank you everybody for the thoughtful comments and the exchange today. I thought it was very helpful. Thank you, Audra and Rob, for hanging with us for the better part of your day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members of the board. Siegel exit the meeting now also. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Paul, you escaped being called upon or having to...
You hung in there. We like it when the lawyers provide cover for us. We do appreciate that.
Hey, you know what? Every now and again it happens, so...
Okay, so thank you, everybody.
All right, so thanks to you and Andy.
Thank you.